Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. How's everyone doing?
Pretty well.
Yeah,
how
same.
About you?
So, on to our first topic, Mr. Met. He got fired after a video of him flipping off fans was circulated. What do you guys think about that?
So, I have pretty strong opinions on mascots. I don't think they should exist. I think they are abominations. So I just thought maybe I'll give it to you guys if you guys have like a more tempered opinion of mascots.
I'm also not huge into mascots. I'm a little biased because my team, the Dodgers, has never had a mascot, and I think that's the right thing to do. I will say, they aren't mascots per se, but I do have a soft spot for the Nationals Racing Presidents as a fan of history, fan of U.S. history especially. I think they're absurd and very entertaining. I remember a couple of years back, I was very excited because they added Calvin Coolidge, who is, for reasons I have a hard time explaining, a president that I have always been really interested in. And so when they added him, I was like, that's super random. But I kind of am really happy about that. It turns out that I guess they were doing a thing with the White House Historical Association to feature the president in the Racing Presidents from that year's Christmas ornaments. And that year it happened to be Calvin Coolidge. And since it was going sequentially, the next year they switched to Herbert Hoover, which I thought was kind of, I don't know, that's not great. It's like you have Coolidge, then you have Hoover, and then you get the Great Depression. And then after that, you have FDR, who then you run into the issue with the wheelchair thing. And it turns out that was supposed to happen this season, but then they just decided, yeah, we're not dealing with that. So that ended up not happening. But anyway, long story short, Racing Presidents are cool. I am kind of sorry I didn't get to see how they handled the FDR thing, but at least I got Calvin Coolidge out of it.
Yeah, I have to agree. I'm not really that big on mascots. However, like costume races, like the Racing Presidents, I am 100% for. And like the Buffalo Bisons have a race that includes like buffalo wing condiments, like ranch and celery and carrot sticks and stuff like that. And it's just completely absurd. But I am here for the absurd and not the creepy.
Yes.
Agreed.
I think that that's probably like the main thing is, so first off, like with the races, they're like farther away from you. So like if you're at the game, you're not worried about like being attacked by a mascot. And then secondly, like you know there's a person, like they don't try to hide the fact that it's like a person under there. But I feel like with mascots, like especially now, they like craft such elaborate backstories and have like mascot relationships that it is just, it's too much.
Yeah, mascots are on Twitter. Like,
yeah.
It's weird. I will say there's one mascot that I have grown to be a little partial to, and that's Orbit. It basically started because I have a friend who is for some reason really into Orbit, and she kept sending me his stuff, and you know, he puts on a good show. I think he's not as creepy as some of the others, so Orbit is the least bad of the mascots in my opinion.
I'd agree. Orbit's more kind of like an adorable mascot in the sense like it belongs on a kid's TV show, so it's not as creepy or threatening, and it's not like, it's not Mr. Met. I'll just say that.
Yes.
To be fair to Mr. Met, I get that he's under a lot of pressure right now. Things are kind of a mess with that team, and I can understand why he would not be in a great mood and why he kind of snapped. But I also understand why the Mets had to take the action that they did against him.
Yeah, it was just, you know, an unfortunate situation for basically everybody involved, except for baseball fans on Twitter who are not Mets fans. And then it was just, like, the greatest event ever.
Yes.
Pretty much, yeah. So our next topic is Clayton Kershaw hits 2,000 career strikeouts. He's the third fastest pitcher by innings behind Pedro Martinez and Randy Johnson. and the fifth youngest pitcher to 2,000, although Kershaw's the youngest in the National League. I mean, Clayton Kershaw, obviously, he's an amazing pitcher, and, you know, I'm not surprised that he was able to hit 2,000 career strikeouts this quickly, but at the same time, I think it's a testament to how good he is.
Yeah, definitely. Again, Dodger fan, so gotten to watch him since pretty much the beginning. You could tell he was going to be special early on, but you didn't necessarily know he would reach the kind of level that he has. And it's just, you know, it's just kind of crazy to think, yeah, it's probably not out of the realm of possibility for him to, I mean, he'll certainly hit 3,000, you know, barring something horrible happening, but he's probably going to just continue to amaze there. And that's, I'm really excited to watch that happen.
Me too. He's, you know, I think he's one of the few pitchers in the league where it's really an event whenever he pitches. And I think that that's really exciting and good for baseball.
I completely agree. And like, I mean, obviously I'm a Giants fan, but I do love watching a lot of Clayton Kershaw starts just because the science behind everything in his pitching, like the pitch selection, the mechanics, the movement of the ball, it's just so fascinating to watch.
Yeah, and just the consistency of how good he is, it's kind of remarkable.
Indeed.
On the subject of milestones, we have another one achieved this week. Albert Pujols just hit his 600th home run. It was a grand slam. If you're going to do it, then do it in style. So on that subject, have there been any big milestones that either of you have witnessed in person?
Wow, I don't think I've actually witnessed anything that's, like, noteworthy or in the history books. The Bonds home run chase was well before I started going to a lot of games and living up in the Bay Area. Yeah, I haven't really seen anything in person, I'd say.
No, me neither. Which is a boring answer, but it's the truth.
That's fine. We are all fairly young. We have plenty of time to see lots of things. For me, I would say I saw Kershaw hit his 300th strikeout of the season, his final game of 2015. And to continue with the Dodger theme, I saw Kenley Jansen set the franchise save record last year, breaking Eric Gagne's record. And yeah, both were very cool experiences.
Nice.
That's the
closest one I've seen is Splash Hit 70 at AT&T Park, which not as momentous as the last one.
Nice. All right. Well, now we've gotten that out of the way. Do we want to go to this past week's articles?
Yeah.
All right. So there was no Monday. Well, there was no article. Monday existed, but there was no article published because it was a holiday. So for Tuesday, we have Should Managers Save Their Challenges by Kolya Ilyarionov. The article talks about how since 2014, there are 49.6% of challenges have resulted in a play being overturned. And so to kind of help quantify this, he created a modified leverage index titled LI7 that compares the challenge situation with the average situation from that point forward in a game as opposed to any point in a game. Which is kind of a more nearsighted use of leverage index. And so you can get more specific stats relative to the success of challenging plays. But overall, umpires get roughly 99.6% of calls correct, which I know some people will probably find shocking. But independent of the inning, so there's no umpire fatigue in a game. They're going to, if they get a call right in the seventh inning, they're just as likely to get it right in any other inning. However, managers should still challenge, since doing so is worthwhile if there's at least a 20% chance of having the call overturned, which there most likely is in any situation that managers are deciding whether they should challenge. So I think that this is kind of a good topic to discuss because there's been a lot of talk about how challenges have been implemented in the MLB over the past several years. So just wondering if you guys like the way challenges are being used or if you think that there should be any modifications.
So there was actually a comment on this article that I thought was kind of interesting. Bob Rittner, he said, if the object of replay is to get the call right, the whole concept of challenges, particularly limited ones, is stupid. It adds a dimension to the game that has nothing to do with play on the field, but rather with playing the odds on the bench. And I can kind of actually see where he's coming from. Having a limited number of challenges available, I understand the necessity of that for sake of things like pace of play, but at the same time, yeah, the purpose isn't to see who is the best at knowing when to challenge or, you know, which team has people who are the best at knowing when to make that call, but it's to get the call right. And if a manager can only challenge so many times, then, you know, that means that there's probably still plays that are happening that may not be accurate and may need to be overturned. So that, I thought that was an interesting point. I don't know exactly how one handles that because you can't have an unlimited number of challenges, I think, but maybe you expand the number of challenges that managers get during the course of a game.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there definitely needs to be something done with that. But then also, I guess, the common argument is how this will impact pace of play, which is a huge topic nowadays. So I don't know how those two can be balanced to make it most efficient.
Yeah, it's true. It does add several minutes into the game time, and it's several minutes with no action. And that is definitely a reason for concern.
Yeah, and I think if they just keep kind of tweaking around with the pace of play and trying to figure out what exactly is the best way to utilize the time, they'd be able to figure out if they have to cut down on how long a challenge could be or just trying to speed the game up. But I also think, like, I don't think it was necessarily thought through how pace of play could affect the challenge rules and how long it takes to get, you know, a challenge, you know, working and reviewed and things like that. And I think that's something that should be taken into more consideration if rules are going to be updated.
Right. I think that, like, when challenges were initially implemented, it was to kind of correct the most blatant miscalls. And so I don't know if there's like some way to maybe go back to that and say, like, if you can't determine whether a call should be overturned in, like, I don't know, 90 seconds or whatever of reviewing it, then it's too close and it should just like stand on the field.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, I can see that too.
What do you guys think of the new challenges at second base? Because I know they've been quite controversial.
I don't like the neighborhood play. I think if a guy is not actually, you know, touching the base, he shouldn't get credit for the out. So I'm okay with that being able to be reviewed.
Yeah, I also agree. I think that, you know, my opinion is, you know, pretty much the consensus. I am not that big a fan of the neighborhood play, and pretty much everything that I would say would be echoing Sarah, so.
Yeah, I'm pretty much in agreement. I think that, like, some of them kind of display the same issues with the challenge overall, but yeah, no, I just didn't, like, never really got the point of the neighborhood. I mean, I got the point of it, but I just didn't agree with the neighborhood play. You'll like this one, particularly, Jen. So, on Wednesday, we had What This Game Needs Is More Cats by Brian Reinhart. So, on May 21st, the Frisco Rough Riders, who are the Rangers AA affiliate, held Take Me Out to the Ball Game. So a lot of people, the author included, were expecting this to be a complete disaster. that would feature a lot of rogue cats. He mentions that it kind of developed as sort of a joke idea. But it was a pretty good event. They had only a dozen cats. They planned for roughly 100. And all owners had to sign waivers, provide rabies documentation, and bring leashes. And basically the cats just kind of like sat there in the sun the entire game. So it was considered a success, and they're going to do it again next year. So how many of your cats do you think would enjoy going to a baseball game?
I don't think any of my cats would enjoy going to a baseball game. They kind of hate the outdoors. Which is good for me because there's coyotes around here. But yeah, I think it's, I don't know, I'm kind of torn about this because while I love cats, I just don't know if I like the idea of cats at a baseball game other than the occasional cat running onto the field and hopefully not getting stuck in Marlins dinger machines. But I think it just seems kind of weird to me in that I never really thought of, you know, cats being associated with baseball. I always thought it, you know, it's more bring your dog to a game type of sport. And cats on leashes are just completely bizarre to me.
Yeah, same. I just, like, I don't understand outdoor cats at all. Like, to me, cats just, like, hang around inside. And so it's just, like, weird whenever I see a cat outdoors. It's just so unnatural, even though, like, cats are obviously outdoors all the time because they come from outdoor cats.
Yeah, pretty much. They're, outdoor cats are weird. That's all I'll put it. Especially barn cats. I've had a couple barn cats. They're just weird creatures.
So, what animals do you think would make the best onlookers at a baseball game? And which animals do you think would make for the best baseball players?
I think dogs are... Okay, I think dogs make great companions for most things. I think that bark at the park is a great idea, and I think it's something that goes over well more often than not because, you know, dog owners tend to be good about knowing whether or not their dog is good around other dogs, whether or not they can handle that. I honestly can't see, like, this isn't a super fun or creative answer, but it's hard for me to imagine many other animals actually enjoying a ballpark experience all that much. Unless you want to talk about the seagulls at AT&T Park. as for the best baseball players, I guess the serious answer would be, well, gorillas make sense because, you know, they can stand upright. They have opposable thumbs. I think that just from a physiological standpoint, that is probably the most sensible answer. Have either of you guys seen or either the trailer for or the actual movie Mr. Go?
No, I have not.
Okay, it is a Korean animated film about a gorilla that plays baseball and saves a floundering baseball team. And I have only seen the trailer. I am dying to actually watch the movie one day. But that trailer convinced me that gorillas would be good baseball players.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to check this out.
Same. I'm looking the Wikipedia page up right now. And... like, even from the movie poster, it looks like a must-watch.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get to that at some point for sure.
Yeah, I think, for some reason, I keep thinking that an owl would make a great catcher just because of the stoic poker face that they have. but that's just where my mind went. I think that they would probably be able to be good catchers, but I don't think I can top a movie with a gorilla playing baseball.
No, I think that's pretty much sums up my answers too, which are a dog and, like, I was gonna say monkey, but gorilla is also perfectly fine, probably even better than a monkey, because I don't know how well monkeys take direction. So this is a good segue into something else, that I wanted to ask you guys, which is what baseball movie do you think would be best improved by the addition of an animal?
Well, like I said before, everything is improved with dogs, so any movie would be better if you added dogs to it, and that's why Air Bud Seventh Inning Fetch is a perfect movie.
Yes.
I agree. I agree completely.
Yeah, so, you know, put some dogs in Field of Dreams, and it's an even better movie then. That's my take on this.
I think every movie should have to have a dog in it.
Yeah, completely agree.
A dog that looks...
I feel like everything in life, especially baseball, should just have a dog in it.
Yeah, well, there's one of my favorite tweets from B. Gardner Fan Club. She was kind of riffing on the whole idea of changing the rules for extra inning games, and her suggestion was after the 15th inning, one position player is replaced by a dog every inning until someone wins. And I'm super into this idea. I think we're in agreement that dogs in baseball, dogs watching baseball, playing baseball in baseball movies, that is how you improve all of those things.
100%.
I agree.
Okay, well, on that note, let's move on to Thursday's article. There's no dogs involved, I'm sorry. But it's entitled, What If the King Wanted to Be the Kid? By Eli Ben Porat. So in this piece that was posted just in time for the NBA Finals, Eli Ben Porat imagines what LeBron James would be like as a baseball player, based on data from LeBron's basketball career and StatCast-derived comparisons to similarly built players. Ben Porat is able to analyze LeBron's tools and to determine how they might translate to baseball. You know, it's like you have this really tall, super muscular guy. How does that, you know, what do we think that means for him being a baseball player? And there's not many position players who are as tall as he is. He's 6'8". You know, people are so amazed by Aaron Judge because he's an outfielder who's 6'7". And, you know, most really tall position players are first basemen, and the very tall people in the game tend to be pitchers. So, you know, what does that mean for LeBron? And it's an interesting piece. The methodology that he uses is intriguing, and you should definitely read it for yourself to judge whether or not you agree with Eli's conclusions. Okay, so moving on to Friday's article. It's a second piece in a series by John Pascal called Coffee Sippers, Those Who Played One Game. This is the position player version of this. Last week, we ran the pitcher version of it. So this one, coming into the 2017 season, there were 363 players who met the criteria of being a position player who only played in one game. There are plenty of reasons why someone may be a coffee sipper. Sometimes it's an unexpected roster emergency. Sometimes it's because of poor performance, although that's usually more of an issue for pitchers than position players. It's worth noting that several people on the list have played their one game in the past, you know, couple of seasons and are still active in minor league baseball and could very well play another game at some point and probably will. But there are a lot of people who, you know, their time is up. And Pascal gives plenty of other specific examples, and he gives dozens of coffee sippers who you might not have otherwise heard of their due. So I want to talk to you two about this. Are there any coffee sipper games for either pitchers or position players that we've watched that stand out to us?
So for me, one that I watched, it was on TV, not in person, was Charlie Zink. And this was in 2008 for the Red Sox. And so he's a knuckleball pitcher, and he was actually brought up to replace Wakefield, who was injured. Because the Red Sox always have to have a knuckleball pitcher on the roster. And it was like an absolutely insane game versus the Rangers that ended 19-17 in the Red Sox favor, with Ortiz hitting two home runs, I think, in the first inning. And it was just like absolutely nuts. And, you know, it's probably not the best game for him to start because, like, obviously no pitcher really did well. But the poor guy did not get another shot, which I understand because we don't really need two knuckleballers, but also the poor guy.
Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah, that's also the only instance of a coffee sipper that I've seen, and I wasn't there. I also saw it on TV. And I just remember that game vividly just because it was a 19-17 game and he didn't really have the greatest stuff. But then again, when you're brought up for a spot start and you're a knuckleballer, things could go awry. But there is, you know, just going through the list of cup of coffee batters on Baseball Reference, I mean, there's a lot in 2017 who have just been called up for one game, but I think that because it's so recent, there's still a chance that they could get called up again. But otherwise, yeah, Charlie Zink would be the one that I remember a lot.
Yeah, well, my answer to this is a guy named Red Patterson. He pitched a game for the Dodgers in 2014. Wasn't bad. I think went in a little over four innings. I think only gave up one run. He went back to the minors after that and stayed in the Dodgers system for a couple seasons, but this year he's a free agent, so that could be it for Red. It's too bad. I've told you two to Google him and see what his beard looked like, but for anyone listening to this, if you don't know, Google Red Patterson, go to his minor league baseball page. You'll see what I'm talking about. It's really fascinating. And I also just wanted to give a shout out to Walter Alston. That's not a game that I watched, but I just think it's kind of cool that, you know, he was a coffee sipper and then he went on to be arguably one of the most successful MLB managers of all time. So, yep.
That's really interesting. I think like most MLB managers who have played before, you know, have had at least a decent career somehow in baseball, but you know, Walter Alston's a special case, and that's really good history right there.
Yeah, I want to shout out another one who's not a pitcher, I'm a position player, Mel Kerr. And he only played one game for the Cubs, in which he was a pinch hitter in 1925. But he was, like, an insane athlete from Western Canada. He played basketball, baseball, rugby, track and field, like, any, like, every sport, you know, that was being played at the time. And he could have gone to the 1924 Olympics, but he declined an invitation. So it's really interesting that with all of his athletic ability, he only got into one game as a pinch runner, in the major leagues.
Yeah. So he's one of those coffee sippers who, so he didn't ever have an at bat. He just was a pinch runner. Yeah.
Yep.
That is really interesting. That's gotta be a rarity.
Yeah, definitely. And it's, I think, really sad in all of the cases because they didn't get to showcase anything except the fact that they have two legs that operate.
For this upcoming week over at Hardball Times, Monday, today, which is when we're recording, Adam Dorhauer is examining the effects on variance on regression analysis. So definitely give that one a read. On Tuesday, David Kagan is writing about physics and baseball, and that's always an interesting topic. On Wednesday, Richard Bergstrom is writing about where ballpark temperatures come from. On Thursday, Brittany Delacritaz is writing about post-game Gatorade baths. And on Friday, Jack Moore is writing about the lack of imagination in baseball fiction. So definitely give all of those a read. And definitely, you know, keep paying attention to the things that people on Hardball Times are writing, because they're coming up with some good stuff over there.
For sure.
Yeah, absolutely. They're all absolute must-reads.
That does it for this week's episode of Hardball Times Audio. Thank you for, you know, taking the time out of your day to listen to us. You can like, rate, and subscribe on iTunes. You can catch me, Jen MacRamos, on Twitter at Jen MacRamos. You can get Sarah on Twitter at SarahWexler32. And you can get Mary at Mary M. Craig on Twitter. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can read all the articles we mentioned at hardballtimes.com. You can follow Hardball Times at @hardball_times on Twitter. And yeah, we hope you tune in again.